Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts here in the Bay Area. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, a heavy dose of Bay Area theater. You'll hear about the ACT production of A Night with Janis Joplin from its eponymous star, portrayed by Casey Clanton. From the Aurora Theater and director Barbara Damashek, details about the Bay Area premiere of Splendor by Abby Morgan. Also on the theater front, Chris Burrell, executive managing director of San Jose's Hammer Theater Center, talks about the screenings of the British National Theater's state-of-the-art recorded productions. Plus, Frame Line 39 gets underway tonight. I'll talk with programmer Peter Stein, who will share some film festival fun facts with us. And he'll be joined by filmmaker Nicholas Christo, whose film Picking Up is included in the Fun in Boys Shorts screenings. Stay with us. Well, the Aurora Theater Company in Berkeley closes its 25th season with the Bay Area premiere of Splendor, Abby Morgan's riveting play about the fragility of power and the unreliability of language. The four-member cast is directed by my guest, Barbara Damashek. Barbara has worked extensively as a playwright, director, and composer-lyricist at many of the country's leading regional theaters, including the Mark Taper Forum, the Denver Center, the Pittsburgh Public Theater, Syracuse Stage, Yale Rep, where she studied theater, and the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. She's created a large body of original plays with music and is best known nationally as the director, composer, lyricist, and co-author of Quilters, which received 6 Tony nominations in 1985, including 3 for Ms. Damashek. In the Bay Area, she has directed at ACT, the Marin Theater Company, and at Berkeley Rep. And her original musical about genetics for young audiences called Code Blue at the Genome Zoo was commissioned by the San Francisco Exploratorium. In addition to her professional work, she currently teaches and directs productions at San Francisco State University. A very kind welcome to you, Barbara Damashek. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Well, this play has been described as a sort of absurdist play. Now, can you put your SF State professor cap on us for a moment and give us a Theater 101 definition of absurdism, using as few allusions as possible to the current administration in Washington?
I won't use any, and I'm not sure I can give a very good definition of absurdism. It's a form that came out of a particular moment and a particular philosophy, but it is definitely a reaction against naturalistic theater. I think that it's also an expression of existential point of view. And contains that point of view. So some of the things that characterized absurd theater were a particular point of view about experience and about the world, and also an experiment with form. Repetition was used in a lot of the absurdist theater. But I think this is actually not essentially an absurdist play. It's very postmodern. I think it was written in 2000, and we're setting it in the millennium. And I think I need to get a little bit, if I may, into the structure of the play itself. I think we're using that title to try to locate the play in terms of where does it belong in the theater literature. But I think it's original, and I think it's an expression of something that started to come out around then, most notably in the work of Carol Churchill. The occasion of the play is in an unspecified country, 4 women are waiting in a presidential palace to hold a photo shoot with the tyrant or the director That was a Freudian slip.
So we get Freudianism as well as existentialism. All right.
Hello. I need Saturday Night Live here. The tyrant or the dictator of this country, outside of this palace, which is also recognizably a kind of shrine to consumerism, you know, the gold toilet is the reference, or the gold bathtub, there's a civil war going on. And this dictator is the commander of the South, which has been fighting against the North. But what's happening outside is on this day, the Northern troops have come over and they're taking over the South. So the dictator is being waited for. That's a very existential concept, that it's a play about waiting. That also was a theme that was prevalent in absurdist theater. I don't want it to be a spoiler, so I'm not going to give it away. But we don't know what really has happened to him. We don't know if he's been deposed or killed or if he has fled the scene. And the entire world of the play is occupied with the four women in the house waiting for him. They are the wife of the dictator, in other words, the first lady, her supposed best friend, a photographer who's come to take a photo shoot with the dictator, and a translator. So there's a linguistic element in this, which is that the photographer doesn't speak their language. The translator often intentionally mistranslates what she's saying because the context of the world is a very edited and censored world. And they're trying to communicate across cultural barriers. The scenes repeat itself so that you allegedly see the same experience five times. And the metaphor for that, I believe, is the photo shoot. So we're even using the word exposures. You see the first exposure, the second exposure, the third and the fourth. And I have likened this in structure a little bit, or in intention, to the old film Blow Up by Antonioni, which is where you see he keeps blowing up the photograph. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, I do.
And there was a murder, so there's a mystery that's happened, and he's trying to penetrate the mystery by blowing the photograph up, and each time he does, another level of the reality becomes clearer. And that's what happens with each of the repetitions in the play, that each time you see it, another level is peeled off, and you get deeper and deeper into what's really going on with these women.
Hmm. What I mean, we have to go here. Was your vision of this play shaped at all by the current political climate that we find ourselves in?
Okay, full disclosure. I think that this, yes. The shorter answer is yes. And we have wonderful performers in this production. Laurie Holt, Denmo Ibrahim, Mia Tagano, and Sam Jackson. Laurie is very facile linguistically. She's fluent French. And when we first read this, her desire was to play the wife of the president, of the dictator, with a Slovenian accent. And I resisted doing that. It's very timely because of all the news about the Julius Caesar production in New York, and all the scuttlebutt about that. I resisted doing it because I think that this is a global chronicle more than a national chronicle. I think the insight of as a picture of the world at the millennium, this has a wide embrace. As I started to talk to the actors, I said, try to put a pin in the map in a country where this has not happened. And there are not that many countries. And even though it hasn't allegedly happened in our country, we've been involved in other countries where it has happened. So it seems to me that it's more of a picture of the world, our world right now, than it is just a picture of our country.
And in a way, with going the obvious way would be too in-your-face obvious. And so you're really painting a broader picture.
I think it would, for this play, be reductive. But the other issue is that it's a very British play. And there's no way to do the linguistic conceit is portrayed without having people speaking different languages. They're all speaking English. But they're speaking that other English, the one that's separated from us by a little lake. And it doesn't really work unless you use British English, which means it's not really American. It was written by a British writer, a wonderful writer, Abby Morgan. It's very dense and beautiful writing.
Speaking of the density of it, the artistic director of the Aurora, Tom Ross, called this play rather puzzling and said he often calls on you for insight into such enigmatic work, shall we call it, as Abby Morgan's. Do you find it satisfying to kind of like crack the nut of these more difficult contemporary plays?
Oh, it's impossible. It's a frustration beyond credibility. But yes, it's the challenge of it that we, the satisfaction comes later in the process for me, even than I am now. But the challenge is initial for me. It's like, okay, bring it. I really think plays like this respect the audience and expect them to move to it, give them a role to work with the plays in a linguistic setting. I just came back from a festival in Moscow called the Golden Mask Festival, and we were at panels where they were interviewing some of the more avant-garde directors who are working in Moscow. Now, that's a whole other story about censorship and what's going on in Russia right now. But they all, surprisingly to me, I have to say to a man, because they're all men except for one of them, stood up and said, the word is the beginning. The word is where everything comes from. And it was very affirming for me to hear that again. But I do think plays like this make the audience work. And I think that is one of the things that the theater does, as opposed to film, which does all... I don't want to make a blanket statement, but film does so much for you. But theater requires the audience to come to the play, to participate in some way. And, of course, in postmodern theater, we've taken that to the extreme. You know, we put you in the play. But I think everyone is going to be on board with solving this puzzle with me and with the actors.
And so the audience, you mentioned putting the audience to work a little bit, not just sitting back in their comfy chair. In the terrific article in this past Sunday's Chronicle Pink Pages by Lily Janiak, you talk about your take on directing, not so much as directing, but as helping your actors discover things in a play that they might not see for themselves.
Yes, well, I think that, you know, I teach at San Francisco State, and even in the smallest module of what theater is in a classroom, where you have actors and actors, I work with them in triangles so that there's always somebody observing them. And it is a team effort. That my definition, I think that Lily wrote in the article, was that a catcher in a baseball game. That's one of the many metaphors I use. But the point is, they're in the field and I'm watching them. And there are things that they can't see because they're exchange. And so I'm side coaching to help them realize their own impulses. And most of the time, what I'm doing as a director is putting a hook or a crochet needle into their own impulse that happened that they didn't notice happened.
And maybe an occasional kick in the pants.
Yes, I'm going to do that in a few minutes.
You're a musician and composer as well. Has that training contributed to your directing of this particular play?
This play is so musical. It is completely a piece of verbal music. I think music is very much my way into the theater anyway. There are many ways to approach a play, and there are many ways to enter the world of a play, and the aural way in is very, A-U-R-A-L, is very, I just hit the microphone, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
is very important for me.
That's all right. That's fantastic. Barbara Demeshek, thanks for taking some time for talking a little bit about Splendor by Abby Morgan. It's at the Aurora Theater. Information at auroratheater.org. It opens on the 23rd of this month and runs through the 23rd of July.
Like you on my own.
That is the unmistakable voice of Janis Joplin. The American Conservatory Theater has extended the run of Broadway's critically acclaimed musical, A Night with Janis Joplin, presented in celebration of the 50th anniversary of the legendary Summer of Love here in San Francisco, and coincidentally coinciding with ACT's 50th anniversary. Casey Clanton is the eponymous star, who is the uncanny embodiment of Joplin in appearance and in voice. She's a native of Northern California who began singing at the age of 5 and began studying at 15, later attending the University of the Pacific in Stockton, where, in addition to classical and jazz training, she learned the art of commercial recording through jingles, songwriter demos, and soundtrack work. Now well established in L.A., she has a studio singing career, models in commercials and print ads, and can be seen in an occasional feature film. In the summer of 2001, Casey was cast in Love, Janis, an off-Broadway extreme rock musical about the life and music of the legendary Janis Joplin. Her name was thereafter inked on a very short list of women who can continually perform the role in cities throughout the U.S., and she, in fact, was asked to join Big Brother and the Holding Company, Janis's original San Francisco-based band, as their lead vocalist for several years. In 2013, she was cast as the alternate lead on Broadway in this extraordinary rock musical created and directed by Randy Johnson, A Night with Janis Joplin. She's currently on the staff at Los Angeles College of Music, where she helped design both the rock and performance programs and continues to teach classes, workshops, and private lessons. And if you caught the Giants-Braves game at AT&T Park on May 27th, you heard her sing the national anthem. Casey, it's such a pleasure to welcome you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Well, knowing the music of Janis Joplin, and as we just heard, my first question to you is, how do you preserve your voice over so many performances and still give us the full Janis?
Very, very carefully. It's a lot of downtime between shows. A lot of rest, a lot of vocal rest. I do a lot of steaming, a lot of warming up, and a lot of warming down. And, you know, I just try to really, I live like a nun.
Well, you were the alternate lead on Broadway. Mm-hmm. Do you have an alternate here in San Francisco in case you have to, in fact, give out?
Yes, Kelly McIntyre, and she's wonderful, wonderful. Great singer.
And, well, let's move on from preserving your voice to preserving your hearing. our regular open-air commentator, Peter Robinson, just attended the show at the opening last night and mentioned that the decibel level is rather high and perhaps earplugs should be recommended.
Well, on stage, the sound at ACT is just amazing. I think it's the best sound that we've had since Broadway. And the sound on stage is perfect for me. Mm-hmm. They have it mixed so nice. I don't know what it's like in the house, but on stage it's beautiful.
Yeah. As I mentioned in the intro, you've been associated with performing the role, at least the music of Janis Joplin, since 2001. 16 years.
I know.
When did you first?
I don't know where the time went. That's crazy.
When did you first learn that you could really channel her?
Well, you know, they came to me to audition for the role, and I used to be compared a lot to Janis, and I never really understood that. I'm classically trained. I do sing rock and blues, but I didn't really understand what they saw. I knew her music growing up, but, you know, I wasn't a huge fan or anything until, you know, much later. But when I was cast in the first show I did about Janis, I started studying footage, obviously, and then I saw it, and I saw the likeness. It was kind of uncanny, just the physical movements. And I don't know if, as a kid, I saw video that influenced me. I don't know how that came to be or if it was just in my natural proclivity. I tend to be a truth teller, so I think we have that in common. And it made sense to me then later. But it really wasn't until it took years for me to really, really fall madly in love with her. Mm-hmm. This show helped do that a lot because it's about the other women, you know, that influenced her, who also had a great influence on me as a kid. So that's kind of where I found my real Janis.
Yeah, I thank my older sisters for introducing me to the music of Janis Joplin.
Absolutely.
Stays with me ever since.
Yeah. Well, I was raised on, you know, all these other women that, because this cast is not just me, you know, it's five fierce women on stage at the same time. It's Aretha and Etta James.
So let's talk about that. In this incarnation of the Janis Joplin story, A Night with Janis Joplin, we learn of some of these influences on mm-hmm. Janis. Tell us a little bit about how the story unfolds.
Well, that's really what I love about this particular show. It's a celebration of the music. It's not a cradle to grave story, you know. And I just did something to my headphones. Okay.
I just did something to my mic. You're
okay,
still with us.
Great.
We're even.
It's a story about these women that influenced her and turned her into, you know, what she became. Bessie Smith, Odetta, Etta, Aretha, you know, all of these different. Nina Simone. These women had a huge impact on me growing up. So when I started doing this show, like I said, I really found I went to a whole other level in this show mm-hmm. because that was my childhood too. Mm-hmm. Luckily, I was raised, you know, by parents who really, you know, listened to a diverse grouping of things. So
yeah. And so as part of, I know you do some teaching and some workshop training. As part of that, teaching people proper techniques so they can preserve a voice and do a role like this for so long.
Yes, I do a lot of that. I have a lot of private clients that work in television and film. I coach different musical theater casts. So usually they call me in when something is very grueling. they
sure.
tend to call me in for things like that. So
after these performances, I imagine a little R&R. What's after this show for you?
Well, I go home to coach a cast of the musical Dogfight. I'll be doing that for a few weeks. And then this show moves to Laguna Playhouse, which I'm currently negotiating. Uh-huh. I will probably do. And then I think it moves to McCarter in New Jersey, and we'll see, you know, what happens.
What else would you like to share with us about what you've learned through this particular incarnation of the Janis Joplin story?
I think, for me, it's been about, the entire journey is about being 100% honest. There is no way to play this role unless you just go out and put, you know, 150% of yourself out on that stage. And it's about going beyond what you think you are able to do and exposing yourself, you know, to the audience and allowing yourself to bleed and to cry and to be exactly who you are and tell your truth.
Nice.
Without fear.
Hmm. Talking with Casey Clanton, who is Janis Joplin in the ACT production of A Night with Janis Joplin. In connection with A Night with Janis Joplin, ACT will offer several interact events. Those remaining include Theater on the Couch. This Friday, following the evening performance, will be led by Mason Turner, doctor and chief of psychiatry at San Francisco's Kaiser Permanente Medical Center. And it'll talk about, take audience questions, explore the minds, motives, and behavior of the characters in the play and the show. And then audience exchanges that remain include next Tuesday at 7 and after the matinee on Sunday and the matinee on Wednesday after the show. Stick around for a Q&A session with the actors and artists who created the work on stage. Out with ACT is on Wednesday, June 21st, the best LGBT night in town. You can mingle with the cast and enjoy free drinks and treats at this popular after party. And you can get some free wine if you go on Tuesday, June 27th for the Wenty Vineyards Wine Series as part of ACT. ACT-SF.org for more information. Oh, coincidentally, it's this whole Summer of Love isn't over just at ACT. Go to the DeYoung exhibit to see this fantastic museumic display of the Summer of Love at the DeYoung Museum. Casey Clinton, thanks so much for taking a little bit more time with you.
Thank you.
That I wouldn't let you talk too much. We'll hear a little bit more Janice to go out with.
Thank you for having me.
Me and Bobby McGee. More information about what Casey is up to is at her website, kacee.info. That's kacee.info. Have a great run.
Thank you.
Waiting for a train, and us feeling near as faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained and rode us all the way into New Orleans. I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana. I was playing soft while Bobby sang the blues. Windshield wipers slapping time, I was holding Bobby's hand in mine. We sang every song that Javi knew. Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing, I mean nothing, honey, if it ain't free. Yeah, feeling good was easy, love, when he sang the blues. You know, feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and my Bobby, yeah. From the Kentucky coal mine to the California sun, hey, Bobby shared the secrets of my soul. Through all kinds of weather, through everything that we've done, your Bobby, baby, kept me from the world. One day up near Selena Sloan, I let him slip away. He's looking for that home, and I hope he finds it. Next to mine. Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing, that's all that Bobby left me. But if feeling good was easy, alone when he sang the blues. Hey, feeling good was good enough for me. Mm-hmm. Good enough for me and my Bobby.
Had to play a little bit more Janice than usual here on local public radio than you hear KALW. Janice Joplin being channeled by Casey Clanton at ACT. Go to act-sf.org and kacee.info for what Casey is up to. You not only hear Janice in this show, you'll hear the touch of Aretha Franklin, Etta James, Adetta, Nina Simone, and Bessie Smith as well. Extended through July 9th now, act-sf.org. Good afternoon, David Latulip with you. Still to come, you'll hear some information about the Frameline 39 Film Festival for which we are a media sponsor, by the way. And if you're seeking a top-flight London theater experience, well, you need not head for the airport. The best of the West End's hit plays starring internationally famed actors are being presented at the Hammer Theater Center in downtown San Jose. Here to talk about what makes these performances broadcasts unique is Chris Burrell, the Hammer Theater Center's first executive managing director. Chris has been engaged to cultivate a lineup of creative programming that reflects Silicon Valley's culture of creativity, diversity, and technology. His prior stint to the Hammer was general manager of Irvine's Barclay Theater. Chris, welcome to Open Air.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Of course. Well, so what is going to make this unique and not just like going to see a movie?
Well, in fact, it marries the live performing arts experience with going to see a movie in a way. It brings the professional productions of the National Theater, which is some would describe as the finest producing theater company in the world. And instead of you going to London, it allows you to spend $20 and come see it in your own backyard with professional acting and directing. It's captured on high-definition video and edited very little, so it's pretty much the live play, and shown on a screen. And so you are sitting in a comfortable performing arts center, and you literally feel like you are sitting at the Vic or some theater in London seeing it performed there. It's so easy for your imagination to carry you there. It's really wonderful.
Well, talk about the special sound system that's set up for these.
Yeah, so they do record with the Dolby
Constellation system, I think.
Yeah, well, the Dolby, it's is it 4.1 or 6.1, the surround sound concept, and we are fortunate to have a surround sound system in the theater, so we're able to wrap the audience with the sound, which it's interesting that you bring that up. In a live performance similar to our previous guest on your show, speaking theaters are meant to resonate the spoken word in a way that it feels like it's coming from all around you. And so by using now a superior state-of-the-art sound system, we're really able to do the same thing with this recorded product.
Tell us about a couple of the presentations then.
Yeah, so you know, we started it in November actually with a production of Frankenstein, which starred Benjamin Cumberbatch and
Benedict Cumberbatch.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you know, just a wonderful production because he played in some of the productions the monster. And then he traded roles with the other actor, whose name escapes me, and played the doctor, Frankenstein. So, but he's obviously a very popular and I guess some people would say handsome actor. So we had a lot of people come out, and it was Halloween time, so that it's sort of
perfect. Yeah,
that.
Sure.
But we've had other things since then, some of them just remarkable. We try to do one a month. We try to do them on the same day of the month, day of the week, I should say. And, for instance, this summer we were going to do a production of Peter Pan, which they produced. And for that one, we're actually trying to do some family programs over the weekend. So maybe parents with kids can come see it at a better time.
Mm-hmm. Now, talk to us about some of the, I mean, the National Theater, British National Theater has some incredible stars they're going to be. What will we see in the months ahead on the San Jose stage? You mentioned Benedict Cumberbatch this past December.
Yeah, well, we just saw Patrick Stewart and his co-star,
one of those series. Was the show?
Yeah, but anyway, but coming up, we have, for instance, Jude Law is performing in Obsession, in Saint Joan, you know, there's some well-known actors. So the point of these aren't necessarily the recognizability of the actors, but what you're really getting is cream of the crop actors. So some of these actors have their names really from the theater world as well as the film and TV world.
And St. Joan actually is going to be screened a week from today.
Yes,
followed
that's right.
by Obsession in July, Peter Pan in late July, and then Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead in September. Who's in lineup for that? And what really intrigues me is the October presentation of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Well, and actually, those two titles, if any of the listeners went to English in high school, you may know that those are titles that you get to read and study. So we're actually doing them in the fall on purpose so that English classes can see, you know, breathe some life into the book that you're reading by going to see a live production of it.
Mm.
And I do need to mention that Daniel Radcliffe, do we all know Peter or Harry Potter, is going to be in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead, and I'm personally looking forward to seeing that, seeing him in that production.
Cheaper than a ticket to London, that's for sure.
Yes,
British
sir.
Airways.
Yeah. Right.
Well, information is at sjsu.edu/Hammer Theater with a R-E, Hammer Theater. Fantastic. What else are you working on for the coming season then for the Hammer Theater?
Yeah, that's good to ask. We're charged with bringing a whole variety of programs, including music and jazz and dance. And we're working on a program where we would marry the attributes of art and technology. And so, strangely enough, the series is called Art Tech. But it will be engaging specific artists and companies that really marry original work with technology. And we feel that that's very applicable here in Silicon Valley, where we have so much technology so near us and around us. We'll also have some wonderful holiday productions, including a Nutcracker, an Irish Christmas, and a local favorite of the of a Shakespeare company, Reduced Shakespeare, doing the ultimate Christmas show. So,
Well, as the website indicates, SJSU, I imagine the Hammer Theater is located on the San Jose State University campus.
Oh, that must be a bait, because no, in fact, we're not. Uh-huh. We're two blocks off in the middle of downtown San Jose. And in fact, that so this theater used to be San Jose Repertory, and I don't want to not mention that. San Jose Repertory was a wonderful institution for many years and unfortunately failed fiscally. So San Jose State has taken over the management of it, and we have a wonderful opportunity to marry the town and the gown, you know, the what's happening on campus, to have the on campus come off campus and feel like that's part of their world, and the reverse as well, for the community to be at the Hammer, which is a SJSU facility, and feel like they're part of the university world. So we really are positioning ourselves in a really unique place to do a lot more than just have some really great shows.
Well, we look forward to the work you do at the Hammer Theater Center in the months and years to come. Thanks for coming in today, Chris.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks so much.
The Hammer Theater Center's National Theater Live Screenings, information at sjsu.edu/Hammer Theater. Well, that 20th Century Fox theme can only mean that we're going to be talking about film in this next segment on Open Air. And what a film festival we have. It's that time of year again, time for Frameline. Frameline in its 41st incarnation. I had a chance to talk with programmer Peter Stein and filmmaker Nicholas Christo yesterday at the Frameline offices. Here's that conversation. Nicholas, Peter, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you very much for having us.
And in Peter's case, welcome back.
Thank you, David. Great to be here.
Well, first of all, let's start with you, Nicholas. You landed a spot on the coveted Fun and Boy Shorts screening. That must be quite a thrill.
Yeah, I was watching Sense8 the other day in Sydney, which is where I'm from, and I grabbed my flatmate and said, that's where our film is going to be. So it was nice to know that we're going to be at the Castro and have two airings of it as well. Is really special for this and for me, I suppose, as well.
There's nothing quite like the reaction of a crowd in the Castro Theater. Have you experienced that before?
I have never been to San Fran before. This is my first day. So, yes, I'm very green, so you'll have to be gentle.
Well, the weather is always like this, first of all.
I've heard. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, for those listeners who are uninitiated, Fun and Boy Shorts is the wildly popular compilation of short films that deal with men in all sorts of gay or queer situations. Your 13-minute film, Picking Up, is one of six films in that screening, which interestingly has two Australian entries, the other four being U.S. entries. And for the gender-conscious and equal opportunist, there is indeed a Fun in Girls Shorts screening this Saturday as well, with two additional screenings, including one at the Piedmont in Oakland. Picking Up starts with that ritual that we all, gay and straight, go through, putting on an outfit, seeing ourselves in the mirror, changing several times before finding what seems right. Is that something you identify with personally?
I want to say that I'm a stronger person, but yes, there's a lot of me in the central character. I think that what we're really trying to look at is how courage can be beautiful, and trying to find that confidence to be able to let who you are on the inside be who you are on the outside. So I think the mirror is, God, the battles that I've had with it. But I think our lead actor, Keegan, who is also in Please Like Me, the Australian TV series, he just threw himself into it. And I was just yelling things at the poor guy during that scene, because we only had half an hour to shoot all of that sequence. So he was wonderful.
Refer again to your actor's lead.
Name. Oh, his name's Keegan Joyce. He's in Please Like Me, which is an Australian TV show on the ABC. And I think it's shown here as well. God knows what network. Yeah. I don't have all the information, sadly. Yeah.
Well, this multiple changes of clothes is all the more ironic because of the major transformation that the main character goes through. Again, something you can identify with there, or?
Well, I've never done... It's not going to be spoiling it by saying it's a celebration of drag. I don't think this is really about how somebody decides to try drag for the first time. I was in the Rocky Horror Picture Show, so I don't know if that counts as full drag. Is that baby drag? I have a pair of stilettos in my cupboard, and they're actually in shot in the movie. So it's not looking good for me.
Rocky Horror might be the starter drug for drag.
That's right, yeah. You get them while they're young, and then you move on.
Where is the bar where the main action takes place?
We shot a lot of this film in my apartment and then at the Jam Gallery, which is in Bondi Junction. So we asked a friend, and we were there for a weekend shooting at really ungodly early hours to get out in time for them to be open in the evening.
To prevent people from pulling out their Google Maps, where is Bondi Junction?
Bondi Junction is the stop before Bondi, the famous beach on the Sydney coast, and the fire department was called to our shoot because we had so much smoke pouring out from the doors at 9 o'clock in the morning. So we had a lot of nervous firemen, which was good. You know, that added a little bit of a frisson to the shoot. So we're trying to capture as much of Sydney as we possibly can, and for people in the know, and for people who aren't, hopefully get to see a slice of the city.
Are you a Sydney native as well?
I'm from Perth, so I'm basically a country person.
People don't realize that's a long way away from Sydney, isn't it?
It is the most isolated capital city in the world, yeah.
Well, there's a great scene of the characters thinking up drag names for this virgin drag queen. Can you share some of those, and were they created by you or you and your team of writers?
That was one of those things that whenever I was with anybody, I would say, hey, have you got any great drag names that you can share with us? My favorite one, I know it's really bad, is An Abortion, which I think is so, so tasteless, but I just had to put it in there. And then Wilma Doodledoo, I think, is also one for the ages. It's a classy film. It's a very classy film.
So we do see this young man witness and then become a drag queen for the first time. It's a really fun, fantastic transformation. Now, you've directed and taught at the Australian Institute of Music, the Actors College of Theatre and Television, Australian Theatre for Young People, and most recently at Western Australian Academy of Performing Arts for the world premiere of the new dramatic operatic drama Melba, composed by Johannes Lubens, for which they won a new musicals competition at the Hayes Theatre in 2015. Congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's about to have its East Coast debut in August. So we have been, this is another labor of love, 8 years I've been working on this operetta, and it's finally having its professional debut. It's a 100-seat theatre, I should add. So I've got to add that as a caveat at the end. But it is really nice to see something get up on its feet after this much work. She was a very famous Australian opera singer, and she had an affair with the heir to the French throne, and then her husband kidnapped her child and she didn't see him for 10 years. So it's this really dramatic backstage story whilst this incredible woman is singing at the Paris Opera and Covent Garden and mingling with the royal houses of Europe. So we're trying to bring all of that together and tell a really human story about a single working mother in the 1800s.
It's about Nellie Melba, the famous, the only Australian opera singer I could even name. So
you must come, then. It's only in Sydney.
Clearly a very hot ticket at only 100 seats.
So with all these directing credits and now this fantastic dramatic work making such headlines, is filmmaking something that's going to be more a part of your life after this experience?
Yeah, I studied film before I did my music theatre degree over in Perth. And, I mean, that was when you were still rendering overnight and it was on film. Now it's so easy to come to film, so it was nice to come back to it. And the joy with which the crew greeted this and the actors and everybody from caterers to costuming, it really put a lot of gas back in my tank. So we're in talks with Peter, who was the producer and the co-writer of this, to film something in September, a script that I've been working on as well.
And might I say, a lovely tank it is.
I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Picking up screens as part of Fun and Boys Shorts this Saturday at 11 and Pride Sunday, the 25th at 1:30 p.m. Very nice talking with you, Nicholas Christou. Thanks, and play safe while you're in San Francisco, of course.
Of course, it goes without saying. Thanks for having me.
Well, we turn our attention now to Peter Stein, one of the programmers for some time for Frameline. Congratulations once again on being part of the village that has assembled Frameline 41. No exaggeration after reviewing the lineup that there is indeed something for everyone between now and June 25th. Share with us some of the numbers. For instance, how many total screenings will take place between now and the festival's end?
Well, we're showing 147 films. Now, that includes a lot of shorts. So we have about 110, 115 individual programs spread out across three venues in San Francisco, the Castro, the Roxy, and the Vic, and then two venues over in the East Bay, the Elmwood in Berkeley and the Piedmont in Oakland. And we've expanded the East Bay screening quite a bit, partly just demographically, that's where a lot of folks have moved. And we have a full day of screenings, for example, on the Saturday before Pride over at the Piedmont. So, and as you mentioned, we're showing one of our real signature programs, Fun and Girl Shorts, over at the Piedmont as well. So we're looking to continue to broaden the reach of the festival.
So close to 150 individual films. Out of how many submissions about?
Well, the programming team, and there are really five of us who collaborate on, we have to sort of fan out across the year, attending some other film festivals and, of course, taking submissions here in San Francisco. We take a look probably at about 900 films to winnow down to the 140, 150 or so that we think are going to be most interesting as a group. That means, unfortunately, we have to pass on many, many films that we would love to show just simply because of bandwidth. We only have 11 days. Or sometimes there'll be wonderful films, but there's a one on a similar topic that maybe is coming from a different perspective that we think, and we sometimes have to make tough choices that way.
That said, are there films that you say, well, let's consider this for next year, or do people have to resubmit every year?
There are films sometimes which aren't available to us because either they're still negotiating for a distributor in the United States or where the timing just isn't quite right, where we will hope that it's available to us next year. Occasionally, we'll have a film. I'll actually give you an example of this year. We have a lovely documentary, also Australian, on a very famous Australian love story, true love story. It's a documentary called Remembering the Man. There was a feature film last year called Holding the Man, which treated the exact same story in a fiction form. And we knew that there was also a lovely documentary about the same couple. We held off on programming the documentary last year because we didn't feel that we'd have room for two films on really the identical topic. But we really, really liked the documentary, and so we felt now a lot of people have seen the fiction film, now see the documentary version of it. So there will be sometimes occasional cases like that where we'll ask a film to come back the following year.
Well, let's concentrate a little bit on tonight's opening film, a loving homage to everyone's favorite San Francisco writer, Armistead Maupin, called The Untold Tales of Armistead Maupin, beautifully directed and produced by Jennifer Crute and Bill Weber, whose previous collaboration, To Be Takei, the wonderful film about actor George Takei, which was the Frameline 38 centerpiece documentary, also with terrific animation by Grant Nailison.
It's a really wonderful film, and it's called The Untold Tales of Armistead Maupin because particularly here in San Francisco, people feel that they know what Tales of the City is and what it represented. And even if that's not the case, even if you're discovering Tales of the City for the first time through this film, you're getting a look at the making of a writer coming out of the South. Armistead Maupin, born in Raleigh, North Carolina, grew up part of a kind of patrician, aristocratic, southern conservative family, worked for Jesse Helms when he was a young man, was a Nixon supporter, and really had a full transformation after serving in Vietnam when he came to San Francisco and kind of came to grips with his sexuality. And there's some wonderful revelations that he makes in the film, as well as observations from others who've come to really know and love his writing and his characters, Ian McKellen, Jonathan Groff, Amy Tan, where you really begin to discover what it is that has created not just the writer Armistead Maupin, but also the quiet activist.
Indeed, spoiler alert, some of those fun facts, one of which you mentioned, his first job as a writer given to him by Jesse Helms at a local Raleigh, North Carolina TV station. We learn about his family, his life in the Navy, and indeed his coveted photo for a long time of him and Nixon in the White House upon his return to Vietnam to do some service rebuilding in Vietnam. We also have some tasty tidbits about the three, count them, three sexual encounters with Rock Hudson, among other tasty tidbits.
Yes, these are among the untold tales. What I also love about the film, it's very much of a love letter to San Francisco, both as it was in a kind of romantic way, and of course the original Tales of the City serials that lasted, you know, in serial form, I think, for, I don't know, years in the San Francisco Chronicle, but also the novelized versions later. They are a romantic picture of San Francisco, but Armistead has really also brought a very clear-eyed view of how the city has changed, how the gay and LGBTQ communities have evolved over the years. So the film, in the way that Armistead's writing has done, does not shy away from taking a look at the impact, for example, of AIDS on the gay community, on darker stories about aging or about ageism. And that's what I really love about the film. It has both a open-hearted sort of Valentine quality to the city, but also a pretty clear-eyed view of how far we've come, both in terms of progress and also in terms of distance from the era in which the original Tales was written.
Again, creds out to the filmmakers for those beautiful money shots of San Francisco, from the landmarks to the Castro street scenes, and again, the animations that come out, old newspaper headlines that just come to life. It's really a beautifully done film. Armistead has often spoken about how the friendships he formed in San Francisco are his logical family, not his biological family. And I'm sure there won't be a dry eye in the house, as he recalls, including his character Michael's Dear Mama letter as part of the Chronicles serial Tales of the City, as a way of telling his parents back in North Carolina that he was gay, that he was loved, and not to worry, he's doing okay.
Yeah, it's a beautiful sequence in the film, which I'm excited to inquire with Jennifer Crude and Bill Weber, the directors, co-directors, how they decided to craft that sequence with the Dear Mama letter, which doesn't come chronologically in Armistead's story in the film. It's actually held toward the end, and they kind of divide up a reading of the letter among many of the subjects of their film, including Armistead, of course, but also with some of these fans and fellow writers and actors. It's a beautifully crafted sequence. So you get not only a beautifully written letter, but you also get to see a bit of the craft of documentary making to bring that letter, which is written as a prose thing, to life.
Another interesting fun fact is that his novel, Maybe the Moon, is which I'm not familiar with, is about a man's relationship with a little person, in this case a woman, and that the actual friendship on which the novel is based is his friendship with the woman who later inhabited the E.T. costume for the Steven Spielberg movie, E.T.
I loved learning that story, you know, along with you, David, in watching the film. And again, I couldn't think of a more apt title than The Untold Tales. You get these kinds of insights into a character, which, again, that's the great gift of documentarians, is even when you're dealing with a well-known person or a well-known set of artistic creations that this person has made, you get insights that only the filmmaker has brought. And I have to say that's true of a number of the really spectacular biographical documentaries we have this year at Frameline. We have this gorgeous film called Whitney, Can I Be Me? About Whitney Houston, another kind of icon, the way Armistead Maupin is. But here you learn, it's a rather devastating film, you learn the toll that was taken on her life and career by those around her in forcing her to live sexually, racially, in every way, to live a different life than who she really was. Kind of like the Amy Winehouse story, the film that came out a few years ago. This is where documentaries give us these insights far beyond what we might have gleaned from headlines, despite our own fandom or whatever you think of these folks. You get to travel a story over 60 or 90 minutes and get a much... this sort of very emotional take on these otherwise, you know, well-known people.
Lots to see and experience between now and June 25th. Frameline.org for more information. Tonight, the screening, The Untold Tales of Armistead Maupin, is at 7. A party at Oasis afterwards. Thank you, Peter Stein and Nicholas Christo, for being a part of my logical family.
Thank you, David. A pleasure.
Yeah, what he said exactly. Thanks for having us.
Information about all things Frameline at the Frameline website, frameline.org. I'd be remiss if I didn't invite you to this Saturday's concert of the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony under the direction of Dawn Harms, music director and conductor. Rossini's La Gazzaladra Overture, which you're hearing in the background, will be presented, along with Mendelssohn's Sinfonia No. 10, Clarice Assad's Scattered, and the last song with Clarice at the piano, along with Laura Karpman's Siren Songs and an interesting take on Ravel's Bolero. It's Saturday night at the San Francisco Conservatory at 8 p.m. Information at bars-sf.org. Rossini's La Gazzaladra as part of Saturday's Bay Area Rainbow Symphony Concert. That's open air for this
Thursday, June 15th. I'm David LaTulipe. Thanks for being with us. A reminder that our shows are archived at kalw.org. And if you got a show suggestion, send me an email, david@klw.org.